I prepared this presentation before I just finished a 500-page book, possibly the most popular textbook used, at least in University of Virginia, where my daughter attended a while ago. It read widespread, I'm sure. And I just finished that book, and I have more clarity about this issue having read this very liberal post-Christian book. So in my opinion, of course, I'm not going to reflect all that here, but I have more clarity about this issue having read that book. Just letting you know that I'm trying to attempt this presentation based on a woman named Eunice, and the whole title is a little long, Eunice Caught in the Crossfire of the Battle of Gender and Sex, Eunice, a Story of Life Redeemed. My approach is not usually this. I want to get to the Bible right away, but this one I'm going to have to wait a little bit. So it's coming, but I have to give you some sociology to put this perspective, to put this in proper perspective. So we talk about feminism. So there are three stages to feminism. Just a real quick version. The first wave of feminism is basically the right to vote, 1920. I mean, that's not that long ago. So that's the goal that was attained, what we call in the first wave of feminism. And then the modern era, the second wave, would be the equal position with equal pay. That's a very biblical concept. There's no reason to oppose that. ERA, not earned on average, but Equal Rights Amendment. It did not pass for a number of reasons, but that movement is called the second wave. Perhaps the most important acquisition or gain made by, you know, feminists is, the nice way to put it, is the right to control her own body, but the more accurate way to put it is right to end unwanted pregnancy. Life in the womb, no matter what the reasons are or the causes are, and some are more compelling than others, but it is what it is, right to end unwanted pregnancy. So that's what was gained in 1972, by the way, for Roe v. Wade. So that was the second wave, but we're not there anymore. We have moved on. So now we are what we call the postmodern feminism, and there are attached two parts to postmodern feminism. So equal to men is a modern, you know, second wave. Equal to men, we're equal to men. Okay, but now the second stage, the first stage of postmodern feminism is you go from equal to men to we don't need a man. It's a different way of looking at the relationship between male and female. For example, the most glamorous figure of this movement is Gloria Steinem. I don't know if you've ever heard of her, but she's still alive. Very beautiful looking woman. And she made this stunning statement, a man needs a man, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. Right. And so, just like Christians, you know, you have to live up to this, but she could not then. She says she don't need a man, but she actually got into a heavy relationship with a guy named Mortimer Zuckerman, very famous publisher. And then she eventually got married. Yeah, so, you know, I'm glad she had experienced all that because that's what she desired, but she did make a statement that many women took as a, like, okay, we don't need a man, but she actually ended up with a man. That's the first part of the, you gotta know this, okay? Which is duped by secular media just eating up everything they say. There's a great confusion over gender and sex. They're not synonymous. When we start using them as a synonymous term, we already lost the game. So now we go from I don't need a man to there's no such thing as man and woman. That's what we are today. You understand the conceptual difference between we're equal to men, I don't need a man, and there's no such thing as man and woman? For this one, you have to meet a woman that maybe you may have never heard of, but you should get to know her, Simone de Beauvoir, a top-notch philosopher in France, neck and neck with John Sartre. She made this statement, and she would be considered a pioneer of postmodern feminism. She said this, one is not born, but made becomes a woman. One is not born, but rather becomes a woman. Now, I know what you're thinking. So, is she saying that there's no such thing as man and woman? Maybe, but maybe not. So is she saying, as we believe in 2017-18, that our sex is determined not by biology, but culture? Is that what you really believe? I know that a lot of you guys are into natural science, biology. So is that what Simone de Beauvoir meant, that one is not born as a woman but becomes a woman? Is that what she meant in 1980s when she made these statements, that our sex is determined not by biology but culture? You know, maybe I'm really stupid, but I'm going to take all of them on in the sermon. Maybe I have this, you know, need to be punished or something, but, you know, tough, difficult subject, but I'm going to take them on. So, you need a clarity. You got to know this. Our sex, is our sex malleable, meaning is it changeable? That there is no biological basis for maleness and femaleness? And know the difference between maleness and masculinity and femaleness and femininity. They are related, but they're not exactly the same. And nobody is explaining this. Because secular media, they don't read. They're not that smart. No, really, they're not that. They just look good, they're pretty, and they'll talk well. And they read the teleprompter very, very clearly. You laugh. This is not a... you can laugh. Because I made a comment, but don't laugh. But you can laugh. Yeah, I should have a good time while you're laughing. All right. It's too serious. All right. So there is no biological basis for maleness and female. Is that what it is? So the key question is, do the words sex and gender mean the same? You know, it seems like that because these words are used interchangeably in official application. This visa application number 5, sex, you know, M, male and female. But then you go to other applications and they use the word gender and male and female. So our society using this term as completely synonymous terms. What postmodern feminists, again, equal rights, modern feminism, second wave, man, woman, equal. The first part of postmodernism, we don't need a man. The latter part of post-feministic feminism, man and woman, there's no such a thing. I hope you understand that it's a substantial difference among the three ways of looking at things. What postmodern feminism is saying right now, gender equals sex. Gender, sex shaped by cultural conditioning. Gender, sex not determined by biology. Now, if you give in to this thought, it's game over. There are actually a lot of things that we need to consider thoughtfully. Let me put it this way. Gender, when sex looks in the mirror, gender doesn't show up automatically. They are related, but they're not the same thing. Again, they are related. Of course they are related, but they're not completely interchangeable terms. When we say sex, we're talking about a biological given pointing to a physical difference between male and female. The 23rd chromosome, women, XX, men, XY. Women have ovaries. Men have testicles. Men have more estrogen, testosterone than estrogen. And women have a lot more estrogen than testosterone. These are big differences. None of the children here, you know, women have eggs. Men don't have eggs. These are physiological differences. Are you going to say that that don't matter? There are so many differences. This is biological given. No culture changed this. It is so commonsensical that I feel stupid for feeling smart for saying that. I mean, come on. Ah, but gender, they're related. See, gender refers to personality traits, masculinity, femininity. You say to a woman, well, she seems very masculine. Why we say that? Maybe she's very aggressive. So we make those comments. Now, you get in trouble for saying that these days. You're not saying she's a man. That she, because we have this image that if you are men, then you have more testosterone, so you expect them to be more aggressive in a collective sense, because there are a lot of passive men, just as important as noting that there are women who are aggressive. There are individual differences, but collectively, overall, and this is not my opinion, I read that book I just told you about. Yeah, there are story after study after study after study after that actually show this, but this book is a liberal book, so they try to debunk every study they mention. They have to mention story. There are so many studies out there to prove that men and women are different, but this book tried to debunk it. That's not true. Usually by way of saying that the methodology was not correct. Usually by way of saying that, well, they use animals. So the result coming from animal laboratory doesn't exactly fit human. That's why we should discard those results that show that men and women, due to their physical differences, there tend to be psychological difference as well. Now, the point is, gender refers to personality traits and social role expected based on these physical differences. That's what gender refers to. Now, that alone is a dynamite right here. You can debate this, and it may get bloody without ever touching sex. That's not the issue. Men, they're physically by men. Women, you are physically a woman. Leave that alone. Don't touch that. You see, point is, can biologically influence traits like testosterone causing aggression and social roles, can they change? So we see boys being more aggressive and girls being more passive. We give gun to the boys and he become even more aggressive. We give doll to the girl and she become more passive. So why don't we switch it around? We give gun to the girl and maybe she will be more aggressive, and we give doll to the boy and she'll be more passive. I'm using this illustration to get your attention. You know what? Let's say that I'm shy and I'm told that I need to be more active. Do you think that I could try to be more outgoing and more talkative, more sociable? Do you think I could try harder to do that? Of course I could. So at an individual level, if I want to be more aggressive, yeah, there are ways that could help me, I'm supposed. Yes, you could change. You could experience some change where you could be more aggressive if you don't like to be passive. And if you're too aggressive and you lose all your friends, then you could be more passive. We're not debating that issue. But in a collective sense, when we talk about all entire women population and all male population, what is the general tendency? Men tend to be more aggressive. Why? More testosterone. Women tend to be more not aggressive, emotional, warmth. I'm not making this up. It's all from the studies. Why? Because they don't have that hormone that causes aggression. Now, you know, you're very nice. You haven't thrown me out. You say that in the academia, you're out. I'm just hearing facts. But at individual level, sure. There are a number of ways that we can modify and change our personalities as we find them useful for maybe search for a new job or relationship. So mini quiz, sex, identity, gender, role, and traits. You see, because gender role and trait can change, when you use gender and sex as equal term, that fluidity that reigns over gender transfers over to sex, and then now you say sex is changeable. Language is slippery. Be careful how you use your language. I don't say gender and sex as equal terms. There's sex and the gender. They're related, but they're not the same thing. So one of my kids was applying to Harvard University, and then she sent me this application. And she said that, it's not working. She said, take a look at this. The first line in this back biographical information said, we understand that gender identity can be expressed in a variety of ways. And then they are given 30 options. The common ones, oh, okay. gender identity, preferred gender pronoun, he, she, zer, theirs, other. And my daughter one time called me. Yeah, I said, hi, who is she? No, call me them. What? Them? I am them. Like, this is what goes on in so-called the highest echelon of the academia. It's madness. You understand? It's madness. Anybody who crossed this is called, you are intolerant, bigot, racist, homophobic, any bad thing that you can mention. This is what I call PPP, politically correct pseudo-physiology. The crux of the matter, can gender roles change? This is the crux of the matter. That's what you really need to get at. Can gender roles change? Because if you say all gender roles are fixed by biology, obviously it won't change. And I don't think you like that very much. What does the Bible say? That's what we are interested in. Yes, gender roles can change as society undergoes changes. Yeah, we... you know, we've got to fix this. Either I give up the PowerPoint or... Because I cannot do both, so can we... okay. I think. Am I controlling it or are you controlling it? Okay, so am I controlling it? Okay, thank you. So we already took the quiz. How'd you do? Did you get it right? If you flunked it, then you should stay. Stuck again. Okay, we got that. Maybe we should just... Okay, so can gender roles change? This is a crux matter. And yes, I say, yes, gender roles can change as society undergoes changes. For example, you know, we went to Israel. We saw women with big guns. They served in the infantry army. I saw Mr. Moms, not just in the movie, in real life. Sandy Sandberg, she is an amazing businesswoman. When I used to travel in the 80s, I saw no men flight attendants. Now, half of the flight attendants are men. We're not talking about whether it can change, it's a degree of change. And maybe there are a couple more things that need to be brought up, which I will do at the end. But for the most part, we're talking about degrees of change, but not the change itself. You see, however, changing gender role does not mean sex identity is not determined by bias. Leave that alone. We have plenty to discuss with gender roles and traits. Just leave sex alone, okay? Men and men, women, women, because of 23rd chromosome, XXXY. I understand that there are some abnormalities. Klinefelter syndrome, Turner syndrome. I get all that. I won't smell what they are. And I understand that the hormone that contributes to making of external sex organ when it's exposed too much in baby's development or too little can affect, and that's a real, actually, stuff that needs to be talked about. I understand that. Not here. Don't touch sex. Men is men. We're born that way. Women is women. They're born that way. But we're talking about whether those physiological differences contribute to personality trait and gender role differences. And I already said to you that you could change your personality. You could actually become what you could not be before in the traditional years of time past. Does biology affect gender roles? Simone de Beauvoir would say, and I'm going to quote her later, she never meant that. When she said that one is not born but rather become a woman, she never meant that women, men are the same. She never meant that. She meant that all gender differences are social constructs, which actually I disagree, but that's what she meant. That physiological differences make no difference in our internal differences. There are internal differences. You may overcome it, you may change it, but there are differences. We're not same, collectively speaking. But we'll get to that at the end of my sermon. So what type of woman are at least pleasing to modern, postmodern feminists? This is 1990, way back when. It's irrelevant because that one of the women who involved is still alive, very much relevant. This is Wellesley College, number 4 in rank among the liberal arts colleges, all women. So it also produced two Secretary of State, Madam Albright and Clinton. Obviously, Clinton is irrelevant to us. So my two cousins who are in their 40s, they went there in the 1990s. And then both of them went on to Ivy League schools for graduate studies. And I'm going to bring them in about how these well-accomplished people, my cousins, have failed in life in their 40s, both married and have kids at this point in time. So 1990, she just passed away last year. We loved her, and my generation loved her husband. Barbara Bush was given an opportunity to speak at the graduation commencement. She was given an opportunity to speak at the graduation ceremony of Wellesley College in 1990. At the time, she was a first lady. Little bit of a background. She must be smart, but she went to Smith College, pretty good school, women's college, but she dropped out to marry George Bush. I think she was 19 or 18. And then she went on to become mother of 6 children, and then one actually deceased. And one of them would become, obviously, President George Bush and the W, and then Jed became governor of Florida. So when she was invited to speak, there was actually a reaction. About 150 students erupted in protest, just like some students who protest penned speaking at Taylor University for their dislike for him. Same thing, these 150 students, they said, no, wrong message to modern women. Why the uproar? Why did they get so upset? They said, well, this is what we learned at Wellesley College, and this is from New York Times. We will be rewarded on the basis of our own merit, not on that of a spouse. You know, that's what we were taught, that we were rewarded on the basis of our own merit, not on that of a spouse. So they said, so to honor Barbara Bush as a commencement speaker is to honor a woman who has gained recognition through the achievement of her husband. No, no, which contradicts what we have been taught over the past 4 years. So she does not, you know, represent the type of career woman the college seeks to educate. What kind of type of woman is Barbara Bush? A type who chose to be a supportive wife and stay-at-home mother. She ain't gonna represent us. That's not what we want to be. What kind of type that she was that they rejected it? A type who opted out of having a career her own for the husband's sake, her husband's sake, no real achievement of her own. Raising 5 kids and supporting husband is no accomplishment. Therefore, we do not want her anywhere near our commencement. That's the type. A type who perpetuates the lie that sex determines traditional gender role. You know, go Google some of this ad in the 1950s. It's amazing. See this woman? She's kneeling before her husband serving breakfast, and he says, show her is a man's world. Yeah, we need some correction. I see this. Wow, that's where the women were living in 1950s and 40s? So it was ready for correction. Nobody wants to live in this world. I wouldn't want to live in this world. I wouldn't want my daughters to live in this world. So maybe God allowed all these things to make some changes, huh? Yeah. But there's always overcorrection, which is what's going on. So they rejected Barbara Bush for all these types that they were told not to pursue as a result of them being enlightened about what women truly are. All right, so what choice will you make? What choice will you make between career and family? You see, what choice have you already made between career? This is really frustrating. I got about 1,000 clicks left. Okay, what choice have you made between career and family? Now, let me go to the text, okay? I really want to get there as soon as possible. So let's go back to the first century Mediterranean world we're living in, because the text that we read comes from the world of today's Turkey. Were these same questions raised by women in antiquity? What choice have you made between career and family? How would you assess your womanhood and motherhood? What would you measure it with? What will be your legacy to children? These are four questions I raised. We raised these questions among us, but were these questions raised by women in antiquity? And the question needs an answer of yeah, yes and no. You see, the choice that most women in antiquity didn't face was between career and family. Yeah, they didn't face that. They just worked. Women in the past, they worked. It's like aggregate society, man. They all worked. So there's no saying, woman, you stay home. No, no, they worked. They worked with children. They worked without children. They worked. What are you talking about? So they worked. So this is false dichotomy. Should women work at, should women not work? The Bible was born in a world where women worked. Okay? Even in the book of Acts, we meet a couple of high-end businesswomen as well. Lydia, a seller of purple, that's for rich clientele. She was a professional woman, and we know that she became the first convert that would become what would become church in Philippi. So they didn't really face that kind of choice, family and career. That's a modern challenge. So we talk about Eunice. We read about her, the future mother of Pastor Timothy. So we're going to kind of focus on her. So Eunice, the mother of Pastor Timothy, faced a different kind of choice that would have determined her success in life. So we don't want to be measured in a yardstick that would clinically say, you're a winner, you are successful. So she had a standard by which if she did well, she would be considered very successful. Now, let me just reread the scripture. Acts 16:1, we pick it up. So Paul came to Derbe and then to Lystra, where a disciple named Timothy lived. And this happened on the front end of his second missionary trip. Paul had three missionary trips, so 46 and 48. Second one, 49, 50. Dates are very important. 49. Front end of year 49, he went there to recruit a guy who could kind of help him because he lost Mark. He didn't want Mark. And he split with Barnabas. So he went to Lystra, and he specifically looked out for a man he remembered, Timothy, a young man. And so he recruited him to join him in his second missionary trip. But we actually want to focus not on Timothy right now so much, but his mother. Only three verses, but we find out so much about her sociological background in those three verses. We know that she was a Jew and a believer, a Christian. So that means she became a Christian during his first missionary trip, 46, 48. Paul probably went to her hometown in 47, okay? He went back in 49. So she had been a Christian for about 2 or 3 years. Was a good Jew, I was a Jew before, but as a Christian, she was relatively young, a believer. But at the time, everybody was young in that town, if you're a believer, right? Now, so she's a believer, a Jew, but a contrast is to follow. But whose father was a Greek. What a loaded statement. Mother, Jew, a believer, father, Greek, unbeliever. You got to pick this up. Implication. Verse 2. The brother at Lystra and Iconium, these are Christian brothers, people at church, spoke well of Timothy. For what? Well, that is something that we need to figure out. So Paul, because he went there to recruit this young man, so Paul wanted to take him along the journey, so he circumcised him. You got to pick this up. Was this a big deal that Timothy hadn't been circumcised? Now, we focused on why he did get circumcised because, you know, he's going to visit the Jews, and if he's not circumcised, Jews are going to have a problem with him. So on a cultural background, for cultural reason, Paul had him circumcised. That's why he got circumcised. But I want to talk about that. I want to talk about why wasn't he circumcised? And I know, other than the fact that it's very painful, I got it done when I was 10, believe you me, it's very painful. But what is the implication of the fact that his mother didn't get him circumcised. You got to get into Jewish world to figure that one out. We're talking about her view of her measure of success. Am I a successful mother? A Jewish mother who failed to circumcise a son. Is that a good mother? So anyway, got him circumcised because of the Jews who live in that area who, for they all knew, his father was Greek. The choice that Eunice faced, it wasn't between career and family. It wasn't the choice she made. But she faced a choice that had just as much repercussion as the modern woman who faced choice between career or family. It was a choice between whether to stay within the bounds of her faith tradition in which she grew up, which means she does not marry Gentile. She must marry a Jew. That choice. And the other choice is to marry someone that would break faith with that tradition. It may sound nothing to you, but it was a monumental decision because making a wrong choice will take you out of all that you are familiar with. But they will reject you over this choice. They took religious matter a lot more serious than we do today. I guess love won over. The choice she made, she married someone that would break that faith tradition. She married a Greek. And she paid a very high price for that decision. Similarity and difference between now and then. How would I, you, women, men, living in the 21st century, assess womanhood and motherhood? Am I a success? I'm a stay-at-home mom. Am I a success? I'm a career woman. I'm a hot stuff. I make money. I go travel. Am I a success? How would I what would I measure it with? I mean, you know, to measure, you need a standard. So what is your standard through which you measure whether you are being successful or not? Eunice, too, raised this universal question. It's a universal question. How would I, living in the first century, assess my womanhood and motherhood? And what would I measure it with? You see, back today, in the 21st century, you measure your womanhood and your motherhood on modern feminism. They dominate. Yeah, I mean, you cross them, you're done. So you measure how successful you are by the dictums of what the proponents of that philosophy propagates in today's world. Now, what about, so I could, based on, remember what those Wellesley students said about Barbara Bush coming and speaking at the commencement? You recall why they rejected her? There are three things that come out from their thinking. Two explicit, one implied. One, you know what? Feminism, number one tenet, you got to have your own career, not named stay-at-home mother. That doesn't count. But you got to have your own career, and you cannot be dependent on men. You cannot, I mean, you know, she got famous because of her husband. No, you got to be your own woman, no man, and then imply sex identity is shaped by culture. Biology doesn't affect gender role. It's all cultural conditioning. That's what is implied in the protest against Barbara Bush. What about in the first century? Eunice, when she raised the same question, am I a successful mother or woman? So at that time, what preoccupied the Jews in antiquity? What generally, whether man or woman, what was really on their mind? It is really the only thing that's on their mind if you are Orthodox Jews even today. The number one thing that was on their mind was keeping the works of the law. That was the number one thing that was on their mind. Oh, they want to be morally pure? It's not moral law. I mean, they did care about moral law, but this is a little different. This was what really worry them. Am I keeping the works of the law? And then for mothers, a top gender role of Jewish mothers in antiquity was, am I teaching my kids to keep the works of the law. Because if you do a good job, then you're a good mother, a Jewish mother. If you do a bad job, you are a bad Jew and you're a bad Jewish mother. What was really important to the Jews in the first century AD? What was so important to them? Justice. Seeing themselves as uniquely distinct from all the rest. We're different. We're distinct. Why? Because we're the only nation chosen by God. We're the only nation. Well, Old Testament says so, so they have good source to believe that. And also, we're the only nation with whom God cut his covenant. He gave us a contract up to bless us, promise made, just to us. You know how special that is? For reasons that have to do with Jesus Christ, but that's not for today. So, to the Jews, to distinguish their identity from other nations, we are different, and they had to show it externally. They will know that you're different, you're a Jew, by looking at you, especially when you are not working on Saturday. They knew that they were Jew. Everybody worked on Sabbath. Sabbath is one of the works of the law. You don't work on Saturday. Today, Saturday was a Sabbath. That's number one tenet, number one of the tenets of the works of the law. Number two, you know, Middle Eastern people look the same, similar, you know, but when you go to public baths, then you will know, oh, you're a Jew, because circumcision is the one that would keep them distinct from all the other Gentiles. It wasn't really for health reasons. Maybe it is, but it was to declare that we are different from all the other nations. We are God. And then when Jews would not eat pork or shrimp, oh, are you a Jew? Because they eat kosher food. We do not eat anything that God prohibited in the Old Testament. These are the three tenets of the works of the law. This was supremely important to the Jews in the first century. This is their life. And your mother, you make sure that your boys know this, and she must make sure that they don't work on Sunday or Saturday, and they are circumcised, and they don't go anywhere near where pigs are pigging. Works of the law. You understand what I'm trying to say? This is first century stuff. This is the standard to which you are measured by, your success. And it was the Jewish mother's role. And they had the first crack at instilling these important spiritual values in the children. It was their job. I'm not making this up. A rabbi who's speaking about his mother says this. A traditional woman, she saw it as her responsibility that her son regularly attend Sabbath and holiday worship services and observe common Jewish rituals. While there were many important Jewish influences in my life, there's no doubt my mother was the primary one. Read this in light of what Eunice was expected to perform as a primary social role and how she performed. Yiddish proverb said this. This is a heretical statement, but I get it. God could not be everywhere, so he created mothers. I get it. Just exaggerated point of the importance of the influence of mother. You know, evidently, a disparaging attitude toward Gentile was quite prevalent, and it is reflected in a typical Jewish prayer that you may have heard. A typical Jewish man would pray, "Blessed are you, Hashem, God, King of the universe, for not having made me a Gentile, a slave, and woman." Man, they strike out all three accounts in today's standard, right? I ain't no Gentile, man, xenophobic and homophobic, slave, you classist, and woman. This is, you know, woman hate. I mean, but that was the first century among the Jewish world. In this anti-Gentile milieu, think that I'm not a Gentile, how would the Jews in the first century and their community leaders assess Eunice as a Jewish and Jewish mother? Oh, good job, Mary agreed. Wonderful. Oh, you didn't circumcise your boy? Oh, wonderful. You think? That was her number one primary gender role. Women, you teach those values and make sure they keep them. She failed. You see, how would a traditional Jew see her? A good Jewish mother, and you put her on that scale, she will probably say, you are an absolute failure, Eunice. Absolute failure, because as far as the Jews were concerned, Eunice wasn't a Jew in good standing because she disobeyed God by marrying a Gentile. They may have used Ezra 10:10 against her because it says, you have been unfaithful. You have married foreign women, adding to Israel's guilt. I do have to make a statement. This is not anything against, inherently against interracial marriage. But in the Old Testament days, Israelite had to be kept racially pure. Why? Because if you have mixed race, then there is no Israel, there's no Judah, there's no David, then there's no Jesus. Jesus was supposed to come from the line of David, Judah, the tribe, and Israel. That's why he had to keep them separate and distinct. Redemptive reason. So you're going to say, oh, how racist. What you're basically saying is that, well, I'd rather live in a non-racist world without Christ. So please, don't give me, there's a pretext for racism. No, it wasn't for that reason. Okay, moving along. Using that verse, they would have said to you fail, woman. And then number two, as far as the Jews were concerned, Eunice wasn't a good Jewish mother either because she failed to have her son observe three rituals very central to what it meant to be a Jew. One, for sure. Two, I'm very sure she couldn't keep that either because it's a, you know, man world. She couldn't get circumcision in the first place. I don't think she could have gotten other two desires that she had. So what Eunice failed to do for her son? Well, we know, number one, that she failed to get a required circumcision, without which her son wasn't a Jew. Do you think Eunice didn't want to do that? I could just imagine, because she married into Greek life, so she gave up a lot. But, you know, Bible said that she read scriptures to Timothy from infancy, so she did not discard her faith completely. Just that her love for this man overcame her faith in Jewish religion. But I could imagine, honey, yes, dear? Timothy, yes? Today's eighth day, yes? Could we? Shuck. No! I mean, I just imagine. Honey, please, be quiet. You think in those days a woman could speak more than that few words? I'm sure she wanted to. But she couldn't. She didn't. Circumcision? No, women. And then very likely, hey, Timothy! Yes, sir? Today's Saturday. Mom said I rest. Rest! Come help me. I got to mow the lawn and clean the yard. And come on. But Mom said, be quiet. Do you think Timothy didn't work on Sabbath? How about this? Hey, Timothy! I got you a pork barbecue sandwich. You know, pulled pork. But Mom said I should not be eating. Boy, be a man. Eat it. Do you think that she kept dietary laws? And then if the woman that raised, honey, you shouldn't eat. He's a man. She'd be eating all good food. One, for sure. Two, likely. What a horrific failure for fulfilling her gender role. There's no nice way to really put this. Eunice, you have failed your gender role. So let's bring it all this home, okay? Measuring one's women and motherhood according to postmodern feminism. Let me review that. Not dependent on men. Having my own career. Biology shapes neither gender roles nor sex identity. Well, how will you measure up to this? Are you doing pretty well according to feminism? You see, two broad consequences. There are many variations within, but there are two broad consequences. How wealthy women try to make Barbara Bush feel. They basically made her feel very shameful. Shame! You are actually a disgrace to your sex. And you dare come to us and talk to us? Shame. Yeah, a lot of stay-at-home mom feel shame. And then the other kind, how working mothers feel, at least at first, guilt. Mothers of children cared for by others. At first, they feel tremendous guilt, as if they're not loving their children. And then there are also regrets. I got this cartoon from Time Magazine a long time. I cannot believe I forgot to have children. I cannot believe I didn't spend time with them. Broad reactions. I know that this is also how I know that my sister-in-law felt. Sister-in-law, I think modern feminism would see her kindly because she worked hard, became a millionaire in land, and that she would be seen kindly by traditional Korean world because two sons that she had, doctor and lawyer. You can't do anything better than that among Korean people. One the doctor, and they are doing really well, really rich. One has 20 houses. Yeah, but for a long time, she wasn't really a faithful Christian. She just worked to make money. And then one day, she became a true, bona fide, born-again, committed believer. And then her eyes opened and realized that her sons did not have Jesus in their heart. One denied God, one just wasn't living for God. And she realized that that's what I really want, for them to know God and believe in Jesus Christ, live for him. She passed away at age 61, and we mentioned her yesterday, and she knew that she had eternal life, but she had a hard time letting everything go because her boys were not walking with God. One did not have God, still don't, and the other just didn't care much about God. And she had all the reason to be prideful. Hey, millionaire, doctor and son, at the end, didn't matter. Just letting you know. If you have kids, if you really, really see this from the true right eternal angle, I'm afraid at the end, if you spend all your time trying to get them into right school and right sports club, even if it's on Sundays, then I'm afraid one day you're going to say, oh man, I shouldn't have done that. Well, she had her regrets. That's why I say some may have regrets and remorse. You know, we're full of failures. Eunice, you fail for not fulfilling the gender role for Jewish mothers. Barbara Bush, you are also a failure because you did not fulfill the feminist gender role. So you fail. Oh, the woman with a wonderful career but who has to leave her kids every single day, fundamental church will say you are a failure for not having fulfilled the traditional gender role. So we live among all failures. Now you say to yourself, what does this got to do with me? Just click it for me. Okay, what this got to do with me? Because, yeah, I'm not even married. Well, whether you are single or married, now or later, you are a prime candidate to experience these internal struggles. How do I know? First of all, you are getting a privileged education that fuels your robust career aspiration. You're not going to this school at first not thinking that you're going to have your own career. I know, I got one like that at home. And a desire to get married, have kids eventually. I don't know any woman in 25, I haven't yet to meet them, who have no desire to get married. So they want it all. And they are caught between feminism and the Bible. I know you respect the Bible, but then you are caught up because in secular school that you go to, Bible is the problem. You can barely mention anything you believe in the Bible, lest that they think that, oh, you are part of that, huh? So you're caught between feminism and the Bible. So when shame, guilt, and regrets are crouching at your door, remember the second half of Eunice's life. Now I'm going to talk about second half. Now, we know that she was a closet failure. I made that very clear. She cannot possibly vote. Yeah, she could be voted for, you know, Rotten Tomato World, the worst mother among the Jews. Hands down. But she makes an amazing comeback because it's a story of redemption. Let's go back. Okay. We go back to the first mission trip of Paul. As I alluded before, this is the first time Paul went to Lystra, right in the middle of his Turkey, in today's Turkey. So first he meets Eunice and Timothy during this trip, since it's the midpoint, I would say year 47. Now, so that's when they become Christians. That's the first time the gospel goes into Lystra and they become believers along with other people. So as I alluded earlier, about 2 years later, Paul goes back to Lystra and recruits Timothy to his ministry team. And this is when Timothy leaves home probably for good. And I remember talking about this 2 years ago. But now we go to year 67, jumping about 20 years. This is Paul in his last days. He's in prison in Rome. Right. He's being wistful, nostalgic. He knows he's going to die. And he writes his last letter called 2 Timothy. And in the letter, he writes something, which we read in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5. 20 years after the Apostle Paul first met with Eunice and Timothy in Lystra, he writes the following about them. So, got to understand the context. He's cold. He's lonely. He knows. You know, this is when he says, you know, I have fought the good fight. I finished the race, and I kept the faith. So, he's gone. So, you know, being wistful, right, kind of nostalgic, and writing this last letter. And then Timothy, he has a very endearing relationship with Timothy, you know, his spiritual son. You know, Timothy, I am reminded of your sincere faith, Timothy, which first lived in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice. And I am persuaded now lives in you also. Because this faith that you have is really sincere. I like that. But I remember that's the faith that your mother had. And you imitated that from your mother. What does this all mean? What does this have to do with redemption or comeback? What was asked earlier? How would you assess your womanhood and fatherhood and manhood and womanhood? How would you measure, what would you measure it with? And what will be your legacy to your child? I want to focus on the second one. What would you measure it with? From the standpoint of the first century Judaism, women in those days, don't marry a Gentile. And for mothers, you better make sure that your children obey the works of the law. Obviously, Eunice failed in a colossal manner, both womanhood and motherhood by that standard. She failed. But her road to redemption began during Paul's first visit in 47, pagan city of Lystra. There she was living in guilt and shame. You know what they are, right? You know, you have situations where you did something you shouldn't have done the night before, and you come to church and you feel lousy. You know that one? So she's like immersed in guilt and shame, and she was surrounded by those who said, well, we got something to take away your guilt and shame. Pagan religion that sacrificed animals. She lived in cities where these things were done, but it did nothing to remove her guilt and shame, nothing. But in the midst of her guilt and shame, Paul came, this man whom she never saw before, but she heard his every word. And he said in 14, 15 Acts, we are bringing good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God. And she heard the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then she said, could this be true? Is it possible that this God came in the form of his son, Jesus Christ, and then he took our sin and died for my sin? Is that true? She believed it, upon which all the guilt and shame positionally were wiped out at that moment. And not only positionally, emotionally, she felt it. Colossians 1:14 became true. In him, we, fair women and fair mothers, have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sin, according to the riches of his grace. And having been free from guilt and shame coming from her many shortcomings as a mother, and she had so much shortcoming, Eunice would become such an authentic possessor model of faith that even a teenage son did not mind emulating. Believe you me, I'm a father of three kids. I would give the world if my children imitated some of my aspects of faith. My son taught here 2 days ago, Friday. Man, that guy talks good. I go, man, I wish I could talk like that. I was impressed. I would do a little differently at the end, but overall, I was impressed. That matters to me. Oh, you must be proud of him. He went to Yale and getting a PhD. It's there. You know, when he was going to Yale, I talked to him often. How his faith was being challenged, maybe co-opted by amazing, horrific liberalism he was taught in the school that was getting his philosophy degree. I wasn't concerned about getting a master from Yale so much as what his learning was affecting him. This matters. And by and large, our kids don't want to imitate our faith. In fact, they don't want to come near us. But somehow, in Judith's case, her son imitated. That means he was close enough to see it and say, I want what my mother had. That's impressive to me. Really, Judith, how did you do that? I mean, usually our kids want to run away from us, but how did you do that? Bottle it, sell it, I'll buy it. Believe me, there are a lot of parents here, I'll buy it. Sincere faith. A upokrinomai. A means none, no, no pretension. No hypocrisia, no hypocrisy. And that's what she had. And Eunice was able to give that faith to her son. I will say to you that that is a success. What will your legacy be to your child? A mother's sincere faith was imparted, transferred, and taken in gladly by her. You know your parents, right? You know, you agree with me, right? This is impressive. I want this. I care more about their being right with God through Christ than anything else. I find it meaningless if they got all the degrees in the world without Christ. I would consider that a colossal failure on my part. It doesn't entirely depend on me. I understand. You see, how would God rate Eunice as a mother? How would God, not Jewish people? It says in 1 Timothy 5:9, no widow may be put on the list of widow unless she's over 60, has been faithful to husband, and is well known for her good deeds, such as bringing up children. Why is it that we elevate short-term trip as a supreme good deed we do for God? Right here it says good deeds, like bringing up children. That's a good deed. If you do a good job, you get reward from God. We never talk about this. Oh, I have to take care of my kid because they need me, but you got to go on a mission trip. Well, you know, you should go every now and then, but if the choice comes down to, I got to stay with my kid for this time, yeah, do a good job, because for that deed, you can be rewarded from God. We value raising up children because Bible says, known for good deeds such as bringing up children. Eunice, the mother, succeeded before God because she embodied genuine faith and then passed it down to her son. So measuring your womanhood and motherhood according to modern feminism, in view of this, the following questions were raised earlier. How will you measure up to this? Not dependent on men, having my own career, body shape, neither gender role nor sexual identity. A better question, how does postmodern feminism stack up against scripture? Stop judging scripture by postmodernism. Judge postmodern feminism by the Bible. We are of the book. Call them out. All right, so, not dependent on men. Man, it's not about not dependent on men. It's about dependent on God. Not about men or even women. For Paul said, not relying on ourselves, but on God, on him, we have set our hope. Don't depend on men. That's right. depends on God. Feminism, you'll strike out on that point. Having your own career. There's nothing wrong with having your own career. To glorify God, not to cater to our excess ambition. Whatever you do, do it for all the glory of God. You know why? Because excessive ambition produces discontentment. Did you know that? Not one more promotion is going to give you the contentment that you're looking for. When the convener in Atlantic Monthly, she used to be ACU lawyer, boardman. So she has nothing to say to help our cause. She one time said, why do some women on Ivy League campuses among the most privileged people on the globe feel oppressed? Why does more middle and upper class white people feel oppressed than among low income women and girls of color? And she doesn't know it, but she's actually proving the point. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. Calling out feminism through God's word. There's nothing wrong with having my own career if you are thinking of leading a modest lifestyle to pay bills, to put food on the table, and to keep balance between kids and career. Nothing wrong with that. But probably the career becomes your God, a source from which you become significant because of your career accomplishment. Yes, gender roles can change as society undergoes changes. Nevertheless, a person's sex is set at birth, and it does not change. One is born, but not rather, well, of course, that's preposterous. There is a distinction. All gender role differences are social construct. Does biology affect gender roles and behavior? Make no mistake about what God's word promulgates. For God created male and female fearfully and wonderfully with biological distinction that affect the psyche. Gender roles of men and women complement as well as overlap each other. There's a lot of overlapping than complementing. A feminist should like to hear that statement. But there's one area that it does not overlap. One thing men don't have. Maternal instinct. This is not a social construct, man. It is psych difference based on biology. I don't know what it feels to have a baby, to hold a baby and nurse that baby. I don't know what that is. I'm deprived of that experience. You see that as a burden, right? Feminism did that. Shame on you. And you are saying that you actually bring disgrace to your mother who nursed you. I don't know what that feels like. But I think there's a bond between mothers and her babies. You see, this is not a social construct to keep women down. Simone de Beauvoir, women should not be judged by being equal only as they are like men. Like, women, I'm successful. Why? I'm as aggressive as men. You think aggression is like a virtue or something? She said, women and men are different biologically. John Darwin, 19th century, also a feminist, very important person. She said, women are less selfish than men because as mothers, they know how to care for others. Did I put you down? Is that a put down? Oh, you men, we as a mother, we don't know how to care for others. You should say that. I mean, is that really what it comes down to? The book I just read, it's ridiculous. You know, women are as criminal as men. What? I mean, committing crime is not a virtue. More men commit crimes. You know why? Because they're bigger and more aggressive and they take it on people who are weaker. That's not a virtue. That's a weakness. Women are less selfish than men because as mothers, they know how to care for others. And because women are less selfish than men, they are well called off to stay home. She didn't say that. They are well qualified to participate in public life. So you want to be in public life, then enter as women. Angela Merkel too many people because of policies. I just went to Greece, and a lot of Germans are just not happy with her because she brought in so many refugees to the country. I love her heart. I'm not a political person that much. I love her heart. I don't know her, but I've seen her, you know, and she seems like, how do I say it without getting in trouble? She seems like my wife. Very nice. Very feminine. Very gentle. But smart. I think she was a nuclear chemist or somebody really, really smart. And she's firm in her principle. And a Christian. Peter, I'm sorry. Let me finish, okay? I know I went way over time. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with it. So sometimes, so I, you know, sometimes I want to talk about my cousins real quick. The problem is the clicker. So sometimes one spouse stays home to show the little guy what a sincere faith, dedication, sacrifice, humility looks like in real life. About my cousins, my Wesley and Ivy League cred cousins, one became a stay-at-home mom. She never practiced. She practiced law maybe 1 year, getting her law degree at UPenn. She became a stay-at-home mother, adopting a baby from China. She can afford to. Her husband is a brain surgeon. But, you know, a lot of women, that doesn't matter. That's your money. That's your career. But in her case, and she is as feminist as it can act. It's incredible that she stayed home. Are you selling that to us? Well, another cousin, she's what I call reluctant juggler due to her ill spouse. She really doesn't want to work. She got two babies, but her husband had a heart issue. 3 times he had to go under knife. He couldn't work. Other some issues relating to his paper, and couldn't work. Still doesn't have a job. And he has a PhD from major university, but he just hasn't worked in 3 or 4 years. She has to work. She does a good job, but she'd rather stay home and take care of the babies.